The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. The first case for oral argument this afternoon would be James Lewis Rogers, Jr., appellant versus the State of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Paul Eisenbrun and Mr. Ellery Gray, attorneys from Rapid City. I understand this afternoon, Mr. Eisenbrun, you will do the opening 20-minute presentation, and then Mr. Gray, you'll do the 10-minute rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chief Justice.
Okay, all right. And for the state, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. With that, then, Mr. Eisenbrun, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. The facts that bring us here this afternoon together come from August 17th, 2015, in Leeds, South Dakota. Late afternoon, about 4:45 p.m., Leeds police receive a call for assistance. It's an unknown call at the time from a Deborah Burroughs. Officer Jant responds to this call and meets with Ms. Burroughs, finds out that her ex-husband has just reported having a very strange experience. A friend of his has said he needs to help him get rid of a body. He needs, he describes having felt this suitcase that's wrapped in plastic that's rather heavy. Upon finding out that Mr. Burroughs, Mr. Kenny Burroughs, is actually still present, Mr. Jant meets with him in person. Officer Jant has some personal knowledge of Mr. Kenny Burroughs. He knows he's a drug user. He describes him as excitable in general. Burroughs relays all these same details: suitcase, awful smell, wrapped in plastic. Says that Mr. Rogers says he stabbed her. At this point, Mr. Burroughs says, I'm not sure what to believe. I don't know if this really happened, if this is some kind of hoax, or if there's really a dead body upstairs. Jant doesn't know what to do either, therefore he calls Chief Wainman. Chief Wainman, come on down. I need some help here. What do we do? Well, rather naturally, they go upstairs and try to knock on the door. They hear some crying, some sobbing, some, I'm sorry. But no one will respond to the door. They try a forcible entry. The police attempt to contact the landlord to get a key, all to no avail. Eventually, Mr. Rogers does open the door. He's immediately taken to the floor and makes some incriminating statements. As the police go in, they find the suitcase and notably don't bother to open it. We're here to ask this court to address two questions for us. First, that the lower court erred and that this warrantless entry was not pursuant to any recognized exception to the warrant requirement. Secondly, that the statements uttered by Mr. Rogers as he was taking the ground were contrary to Miranda and therefore should have also been suppressed. The first warrant exception argued by the state in this matter was exigent circumstances. And I'm here to tell you that exigent circumstances does not apply. State versus Max, decided by this court, is probably a very good, maybe not a gold standard, but a very, very solid case of what exigent circumstances would hopefully look like. We've got Broadway Avenue down in Yankton. We've got a police officer and a gas station attendant being fired upon after police cordon off the area. They start investigating house to house. They notice a house with some bullet holes coming through a screen and some .22 casings on the ground. In that case, officers attempted to get a warrant. They came to the door. They had a peaceable entry, but they had an awful lot going on with true emergency circumstances, being as someone was actually actively being fired upon a little bit before. This case, however, really lacks any ongoing crime. We don't have anything like a shooting. We've got a report, an admittedly not quite believed report, of a dead body. Furthermore, we've got no probable cause for entry into this home. at a best case scenario, you can believe Kenny Burroughs and hear that there may be a body in here, but not of the sort that's going to require immediate entry into the home of a private citizen.
Doesn't the officer need to verify whether or not the poor unfortunate individual is indeed dead?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Chief Justice, because ordinarily, or in some sets of circumstances, I would agree that the officer does need to make that verification. But this particular set of facts is completely lacking in any indication that we're dealing with a live human being. If we take it back to the report that Jant received from Burroughs, we have a terrible smell. We've got a suitcase that's wrapped in plastic that's very heavy. There's no indication from Mr. Rogers' hearsay report to Jant that there's anyone alive. He says she's dead. He says, I need to help. I need your help getting rid of a body. And notably, when police do finally enter the home, they don't try to open that suitcase. Apparently, a reasonable person under these circumstances, like Chief Wainman, would not believe there's any human to be rescued.
What about the fact that when they're in the hallway, they hear somebody crying, and it sounds like he's saying, I'm sorry, to somebody else? That suggests that somebody might have been alive in there.
Justice, I do agree that we could apply assumptions to given facts to arrive at information. But what we shouldn't do here is permit the state to speculate based on their lack of knowledge. So, point well taken, police walk down the hallway and hear crying, sobbing, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. That does sound like a situation where something has gone wrong, but only very generally so.
So what were the police supposed to do?
The police, I think, were right to knock on the door. I think the police were right to call out. But given that there were two officers here, that they had time to attempt a physical forced entry with tools, as well as time to make a phone call to the landlord, I think they should have called for a warrant. That's another way that State v. Max is very impressive, because this is, I think, the late 70s when Max was decided. And that would have meant probably going to find a payphone or a private phone in someone's home to attempt to call the magistrate. But more than likely, in a 2016, 2015 scenario, everyone's got a phone available at their hip.
Well, but doing that, they still have to have an affidavit prepared and signed, and they have to read it to the magistrate verbatim. You don't do that off of a payphone or someone else's home. You have to go prepare the affidavit.
Which is what makes State v. Max so impressive, that they managed to pull this off sometime in the late 70s.
Well, I'm talking about now.
Agreed, Justice, agreed. Given the current state, Chief Wainman testified that he agreed that electronic warrants can be obtained very, very quickly this day and age. So there was no dispute from law enforcement in this case that it wouldn't have been difficult to track down the warrant.
Wouldn't you think hearing a voice on the other side of the door saying, I'm sorry, means that person is talking to somebody who's alive to hear that?
I would, accept that Mr. Burroughs didn't describe any live human beings in the home from his visit. So if there was a new person in there, that wouldn't relate to any dead body, of course, Chief Justice.
So some of the important evidence in the case involved what they found inside the residence. What about the risk of destruction of evidence caused by the delay or potentially flight by the defendant?
Those are excellent questions, Justice. I think the answer is available in the record. First, we don't have any evidence in the record that there was any attempt to destroy evidence. In fact, to the contrary, we have some information in the record that Mr. Rogers was incapable of getting rid of the evidence on his own, which is why he'd asked Mr. Burroughs for assistance.
Well, the police already knew that this gentleman was looking for help to bury the body. Isn't that destruction of the evidence?
Yes, Chief Justice, and I think that's my point. His admission that he needs help to do it means he can't do it on his own. This record is otherwise lacking in any information that he is capable of destroying the evidence in this case.
But we're viewing that in retrospect, right, counsel, from what we now know?
Well, no, I'm taking that from prior to entering the home. Based upon Mr. Rogers' statement to Mr. Burroughs, "I need your help in getting rid of a body," it would indicate that he is not capable of disposing of the body. The bodies are notoriously difficult to get rid of. I suppose that's probably why we have the phrase in English, "skeletons in the closet." Moving on to the community caretaker analysis in this case, the court below found that this was an active crime scene. So I think right off the bat, the community caretaker can be written off. I think it's impossible, given that this court has said that first we've got to have an entry that's completely separate from an investigatory purpose, and then second, we need articulable facts. That kind of collapses into a weird scenario where we've got, on the one hand, an exigent circumstances claim that we're after maybe this body, and on the other hand, we're just taking care of the community. Oh, by the way, we're definitely after this body. There's no way with the lower court finding this is an active crime scene that we can say they weren't entering on an investigatory purpose. Even if that weren't the case, all of the information that we've got left from law enforcement here, if they're required, as they are under the second prong, to articulate the reason for their health reason or safety reason for going in, we're really going to be left with those statements from Kenny Burroughs, which is going to kick it right back into an investigative entry. As far as the likely response from the state regarding inevitable discovery, I would simply ask that this court not apply it. You know, it really requires an independent investigation in this matter. There is nothing more that we can imagine that they could have gathered, and frankly, there was not a separate independent investigation going on. Providing access to a home in this matter on a warrant that could have been gathered after the fact would completely bypass the Fourth Amendment, and so we're asking that the court deny any request by the state for relief on that ground. I've got nothing more to present, so I'll see the remainder of my time unless the court has questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the bench?
I do.
You're not quite done yet.
Yes, Chief Justice.
Eisenbrob, do you want to address you raised another issue on the statements?
Yes, the Miranda issues. Yeah, I would be happy to.
It's up to you. I don't want you to waive it.
I can leave it to Mr. Gray as well. It's kind of how we.
Well, you really can't up, because all he can do is rebut what the state says. So if the state's smart enough not to bring that up, he doesn't get to go there either.
Fair enough.
You don't have to say a lot, though.
That's true. Given this set of circumstances, when Mr. Rogers is taken to the floor by law enforcement, fairly certain that it's not a voluntary exchange. I think it's also fair to note that this is his best opportunity. This is the best statement he could possibly get. He's not actually in interrogation. He's not actually in handcuffs yet, or maybe he is. That's a little bit unclear by the record. But notably, he's not in a more formal hostile setting. So had this been suppressed, as we're requesting this court do, I think it would really change trial strategy. It would give the defense an opportunity to present the clearly in handcuffs, in custody, interrogation statements in a very different light than they were otherwise.
So if the statements were suppressed, he had already given two other interviews to law enforcement. Would the admission of the statements made at the time of his arrest in the apartment building be harmless?
Well, no, I don't think so. Those later statements after he knew they found the body, whether or not he had actually caused the killing, but after he knew they found the body and had said he'd done something bad, and he's in custody, at that point it may look like he has nothing left to do but claim responsibility. So I don't think it's entirely harmless, though I understand the court's question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Sometimes it only takes minutes for a life to disappear, and that's what these officers were up against in this case. This is a savvy defendant, which goes to Justice Kern's question. He knows how to destroy evidence. He's already washed the body off in the bathtub to try to get rid of the bruises. He knows that he's thought about putting her body in the garbage. He has a plan, and we don't know this at the very beginning when the officers are first talking to Kenny the tipster, but he's already thought about throwing her body in the river. So what do we have? We've got Kenny. He comes and tells his ex-wife, I think James has done something pretty wrong here. You need to contact the police for me. What do they know from Kenny? Kenny is not a pillar of the community. He does have a drug problem, and they've used him before in some different instances in investigating things. But generally, he's always told the truth. And he says, this friend of mine, the defendant, says he killed Caitlin. And they have a turbulent, long history of problems. They should have stayed away from each other. They don't get along. And the officer who is investigating this contacts his supervisor. The supervisor knows this. Chief Wainman, he goes to the apartment building. It doesn't take them long to get there. And he knocks on the door. He tries to get the defendant to come out. He can't succeed that way. He tries to call the landlord. He's got a cell phone, but he's moving quickly because he's trying to save a life. He's not worried about getting the paperwork from in one of these telephonic warrants, and they're not instantaneous. Wainman did not agree he could get one quickly. He just said they're faster than getting a normal warrant. And in fact, Jant says sometimes it's difficult because a magistrate might be tied up. So they're moving quickly. They're trying to get in the door. They're trying to find out if this woman is still alive. And that's why we have the exception of exigent circumstances to the warrant requirement. And we can't get more of an emergency here. It's just like the situation in Fisher. It's just like a car accident. Somebody's life might be hanging in the balance. This woman could be trying to breathe in that suitcase, and nobody knows. Kenny didn't see a body. Nobody knows if she's alive. They've got to do the best they can under the circumstances. And as far as inevitable discovery, it's August in the Black Hills. They're in a public building. The defendant's crying, I'm sorry. I am so sorry. Somebody is going to notice. He's not going to be able to get away with this forever. He's got a decomposing body in the closet in his bedroom. And somebody's going to find out. And already, both Kenny and his wife, his ex-wife, know about this. It's not going to go unnoticed, and the past history is not going to go unnoticed. And as far as the community caretaker exception, these law enforcement officers can't leave. They have a duty to stay there. They are first responders. They've got to make contact with the victim. They've got to find out if she's alive. And moving, just unless there are any questions on that issue, I'm going to move real quickly to the second issue.
Does the record indicate, now you've got an officer there and you've got his supervisor, was there any other people higher up the chain available, or was it they were going to have to handle it on their own?
That's a good question. From the reading of the suppression hearing, what I read was during cross-examination, Wainman says that they do have a good relationship with the local sheriff's office, but at this point, he's focused on getting to this girl and getting to her and getting to her fast because he's afraid that she might just be comatose and maybe something can be done to help her. And so they do have that relationship that they can use, but nothing's developed on the timing. I think if you look at Fisher, they've got it timed down to 7 minutes, 5 minutes, an hour, 6 minutes to go to Lake, an hour to Lake Andes, another 6 minutes. We don't have that developed in this record. It's self speculation how long that would have taken if you did it by a telephonic warrant. And it's going to depend on the circumstances. I went back and looked at the calendar, and the 17th of August was on a Monday night. So I don't know how busy their court would have been at that time.
Well, and if these officers are so concerned about her safety, why do they pull back then when they see the suitcase? They don't open it.
They don't open the suitcase.
Or not in there.
Yeah, and that's another good question. The reason they don't open the suitcase is because by that time, when Wayman lifts it, he can tell that Caitlin's a tiny person. It's heavy. It's seeping liquids. And the smell is decomposition is so overwhelming that he's very certain that she's deceased. And I think they wanted to make sure that they had medical assistance when they opened up the suitcase. Suitcase isn't ultimately opened until a couple days later when the pathologist goes in to see if he can determine when she died, and they never were able to tell that for sure. So I think he got to the point where he realized there was no hope, and that's why the suitcase isn't opened. As far as the defendant's second issue and the Miranda warning, they're moving fast. They don't have time to stop and give Miranda warnings. He's not in formal custody. He's being detained while they go in and try to find this gal, and they want to make sure he's not going to interfere with what they're doing. He's right there in the hallway. He's not on the curb in a car. He could become enraged again, or he could become upset. They want to make sure that they can go in, do the sweep, try to find the victim. And even during the first sweep, they can't find the victim. So he has to come back out. Wayman has to come back out and say, where is she? I can't find her. And the defendant spontaneously says, in the closet. He says, yours? And he says, yes. And that's all we're talking about, a 14-word exchange. It's not high-pressure interrogation. So if there,
how can you say, though, he wasn't in custody? I mean, when you hear the words placed on the ground, I think we all know what that, I mean, that usually means it's a little bit more than the plain words.
But it's a two-part test. It's not just the fact that you might be placed on the ground or you might be handcuffed. It's the whole picture. And the whole picture here, the overarching concern was this emergency. Just like you see when there's a car accident or, you know, if there was a stabbing in the street. It's a two-part test. It's not just how the defendant is feeling, although that could be a deciding factor. But in this case, if this is an emergency, I don't know what would be. They are trying so hard to save this girl's life and not able to do so. Unfortunately, Kenny is not crying wolf, and she's already dead. And nobody deserves to die like this, let alone this defenseless young girl. And we'd ask that you affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Gray, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Where I would like to begin is maybe where opposing counsel kind of eloquently stated, look, we've got this emergency situation, and these officers don't have time to follow up on the paperwork. They need to get out there and address this emergency. And of course, if we frame our constitutional rights in that way, people's rights will lose out every time. And that's why we have the careful balancing tests for the exigent circumstances that this court and other courts have recognized. And so rather than simply saying, well, anytime there's an emergency, the police then basically have a blank check to go in, we have to stop and look at the actual standards that are in place. And how I would frame the issue is, first of all, this is really a probable cause case. Is there probable cause to believe that that emergency is going on in apartment 303? You've got the tipster. You've got Kenny. He's known by law enforcement to be excitable. He's known to be a methamphetamine user. And he himself states several times he's not even sure if this is an accurate tip. He doesn't know for sure what happened. Agents go out. They knock on the door. They hear the words, "I'm sorry," which can be construed in a lot of different ways, but if you listen to the actual recording itself, it doesn't sound like he's actually, that is, Mr. Rogers, talking to somebody else. It sounds like he's wailing. And so the question then becomes, at this point, do they have probable cause to believe the actual tip itself? And to take the probable cause analysis to the next step, if they do believe the tip, if they do believe the report of a dead body in a suitcase that smells wrapped in plastic that's been stabbed, Do they now have probable cause that there is an emergency, or do they merely have probable cause that a murder has been committed? And this is where I'll come to the question that I think that this court has. What should these officers have done? They have this report of a dead body. What do they do? Or what should they do? And my answer is they should have contacted the magistrate judge. They should have had the magistrate make that determination if probable cause was present or not. And that really is the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment. You have reasonableness, you have the protection of the home, and where possible, it should be a judge deciding if probable cause exists, not the officers. So what could these officers have done? If we're concerned about destruction of evidence, if we're concerned about flight, case law is filled with examples where officers are able to control a scene. They're able to watch from outside without exposing their presence there. There's no indication that Mr. Rogers was inside and knew that anything was going to happen. I'm here kind of to the next critical distinction. If you listen to the recording, you can hear Chief Wayman outside when he's knocking on the door. He says words to the effect when he's listening to Mr. Rogers in there. He says, "I don't know if he's heard in there or what." And that's really the key, is the agents of the state don't know. And probable cause requires not absolute certainty, but that they have some knowledge of what's going on and something to argue from to say, look, this is why we think this is going on, this is why we need to go in, as opposed to saying, we don't know what's going on, and that's why we have to go in to dispel what's taking place here.
Well, this is a little above whim and caprice, isn't it?
I guess it depends upon how we define probable cause. If our tipster, if we find him to be credible, which I would first argue that this is scraping the bottom of the barrel here, if we've got a known methamphetamine user who's known to be excitable, if his tips are good enough to get us into people's homes, it doesn't take a lot. If we believe his tip, then we have a tip of a dead body. And I'd like to maybe distinguish that. That doesn't mean that every time we hear that there's been a murder, that that means there can't be an emergency doctrine. There could be circumstances where it's reasonable to assume or hope that someone is still alive. Perhaps if Kenny had described seeing Miss Walsh on the bed and unresponsive but not seeing any bruises. But here we have something way beyond that. We have the description of someone being placed in the suitcase after being stabbed, with the smell and being wrapped in plastic. Maybe to use the other extreme, I suppose if someone said, hey, I found a skeleton buried in the basement, well, there's no emergency doctrine because we can't help that person. So where do we fall on the spectrum where, hey, I just saw someone stabbed and I don't know if she's alive or not? I would argue that we're getting much closer to the English term skeleton in the closet if we look at this particular case based on what we have described to us.
But isn't the question one of clearly erroneous findings? I believe the trial court actually found, after listening to the officers, that the officer believed somebody else was in there, in the apartment.
Well, I think we always look at it from the objective standpoint. What would the officer reasonably believe, not what he subjectively believe, I think is a Fourth Amendment standard that we typically employ. If that answers the court's question, I would then move on to does the community caretaker function apply here? And I think Deneau, if I'm pronouncing that case correctly, State versus Deneau, decided by this court, that's the big community caretaker case. In that particular case, that exception applied because law enforcement was going out to a home in the country to look at reports of some stolen gas. Apparently some meters had been broken into. Officers show up and they smell overwhelming gas. And the officers testify, we went into the house because we smelled gas. We wanted to make sure no one was in there. We didn't go in for any type of a crime detection. After we went in, that's when we found stuff for a methamphetamine lab. In that case, the trial court in Deneau found those officers to be very credible and said, these guys are not going in to investigate a crime. They're going in to help. In our case, we have a findings by our circuit court very different. Here our circuit court found that this was an active crime scene, and that's why the agents needed to go in. So really, I think we're under the emergency doctrine as opposed to the community caretaker function. And Chief, you're looking at me like you had a question, but
no.
I'll continue then. Inevitable discovery. This court addressed inevitable discovery in State versus Shearer. And in that case, the court said you need to be careful with that exception. It should be used with a surgeon's scalpel, not with an axe. If we use it too broadly, then we can eliminate basically the probable cause or warrant requirement. In our brief, we cited United States versus Wilson. It's a Fifth Circuit case from 1994. And the Fifth Circuit, what they do is they employ a test that says that the independent source can apply if law enforcement is already engaged in another active investigation, which would have eventually uncovered what they were looking for. And so to say here, well, it's a Monday night, it's August, it's we all know how hot it gets out in the hills, eventually this would have been discovered. If we were to follow that line of reasoning without requiring law enforcement to have already been engaged in another kind of investigation, it would be very difficult to ever imagine a circumstance where we couldn't argue inevitable discovery and basically eliminate the warrant requirement. So I think that the test that was discussed in U.S. versus Wilson would be an appropriate test, and I think that that dovetails very nicely with this court's position in State versus Shearer. I'll touch on the Miranda issue briefly. You've got a guy that's on the ground, according to Officer Jant, he's in handcuffs. According to Chief Wayman, maybe he's not cuffed yet, and he's being asked questions. He's in custody. He's being interrogated. Now, the issue in my mind isn't whether or not Miranda was violated, but is that harmless error? At trial, my closing argument was first-degree manslaughter. I did not argue actual innocence. That would certainly feed into potentially a harmless error analysis. What I have to say to support that particular position is, had those initial statements been suppressed, these are statements that were made on the scene. These are not statements that were made in a station house where I could argue coercion or duress. Those would really be potentially, from the mind of a jury, the most uncoerced statements that would be out there and perhaps the most powerful. When the court looks at harmless error, my understanding would be the Chapman standard. Is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And I respectfully submit that this court should not find beyond a reasonable doubt that those entry of those initial statements would be harmless. Ultimately, I respectfully submit that the search issue comes down to one of probable cause. Is a tip from a man who is unsure himself. He is unsure himself, and he is saying, look, there's a body in there, I'm not sure, and we know that he's a methamphetamine user, we know that he's excitable, we know that the statement, I'm sorry, when listened to it on the actual recording, is very ambiguous. I would respectfully submit that probable cause is lacking, and we'd ask the court to reverse the convictions in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Thank you.